Today, I'm joined by accomplished women around the globe to discuss the 2024 International Women's Day theme, which is Invest in Women, Accelerate Progress. The United Nations is rallying behind the call to invest in women, accelerate progress at this International Women's Day for 2024. The United Nations also states that investing in women is also a human rights issue. As time is running out, gender equality remains the greatest human rights challenge. Investing in women is a human rights imperative and cornerstone for building inclusive societies. Progress for women benefits us all. Ending poverty, the COVID pandemic, geopolitical conflicts, climate disasters, and economic turmoil have pushed an extra 75 million people into severe poverty since 2020. This could lead to more than 342 million women and girls living below the poverty line by 2030, making immediate action crucial. Therefore, the United Nations suggests implementing gender-responsive financing. Due to conflicts and rising fuel and food prices, recent estimates suggest that 75% of countries will curb public spending by 2025. Austerity negatively impacts women and crowds out public spending on essential public services and social protection. This International Women's Day, let us come together to transform these challenges into opportunities and shape a better future for all. I'm joined by accomplished women across the globe and we'll be looking at their insights. Could we please begin by introducing yourselves?
Hello everyone, I'm Ankita. I'm joining in from India. So I stay in Mumbai, India. I'm a software developer and I mostly work on developing climate-related technologies like building solutions for clients working on climate action. Or working for combating climate action.
I'm Kuala Lumpur, Malaysia. I am involved with the aerospace, high tech, and energy sector, particularly in a petroleum industry. At the same time, I'm also involved with the data sciences and data satellite. So I build satellite as well. So it is an honor for me to receive an invite from Anum Farooq to be part of this important discussion for women development or women empowerment.
So hello, everyone. I'm Dr. Abigail. It's very much nice to meet you all. I feel very, very blessed to be among such great women taking such great initiative as well. Yes. So as my name goes, it's Dr. Abigail Hansen. I currently reside in Ghana. I'm a co-CEO of Cozy Hands Company, which is a frozen food company, and also a founder of Versatile NB and as well as Eco-Sustained Africa, which has to do with climate activism, women empowerment, and gender equality. So thank you very much. That's just a little about me. Thank you.
Again, really happy to be here. Thank you so much for having me in this panel. I am Ayadi, again from India. I'm an architect currently doing my master's in rural technology and development from IIT Bombay. I serve as one of the advisors to the UN Decade and I work for, again, ecosystem restoration and majorly focusing on the technology alternatives for rural areas and, again, vulnerable communities. So that's a little about me.
Fantastic. I mean, it's so great to have everybody on board today. One of the burning questions that I have is that we'll be looking at is how to overcome barriers to women's financial access and empowerment. And now this is something that affects women across the globe, whether that's the global north or the global south. And it's not limited by territory. For instance, it's well known that women have greater statistically proven labor, whether that's formal labor or informal labor, paid or unpaid labor, because of the gender disparity. But we're also seeing in more economically developed countries, women that are graduates, women that are career professionals, who are possibly caregivers as well, experiencing poverty. And this is something that is kind of developing globally. And there's this pockets, because sometimes some of these women are vulnerable. They might not have the socioeconomic support that's widely available. They might be, for example, disabled, which makes them more vulnerable. And then add on the caregiving role, which again adds another layer of vulnerability. So we're kind of seeing this, I would say, economic oppression globally. Then on the other side, you have the classic or the stereotypical example of what is seen as a woman who is mired in poverty, for instance, who has a lack of education, lack of access to social justice, economic groups. The question in essence is how to overcome barriers to women's financial access and empowerment.
I think that overcoming barriers to women's financial access and then, I mean, empowerment requires addressing factors such as, you know, barriers in education that most women around the world, I mean, faces. And then also factors such as limited access to discriminatory laws, as well as cultural norms that so many women in different countries face, lack of collateral and limited financial literacy around the world. So I think these are some of the factors we can tackle to, you know, curb this current issue we have as women. Thank you.
Absolutely, absolutely. Sue, would you like to add on to that?
In my personal opinion, because I will speak according to my perspective in my sector, I agree with Dr. Abigail that, you know, education must be part of this empowerment, whether for women empowerment or financial. I give example in my sector because I'm in an advanced sector. In an advanced sector like mine, I'm in aerospace. We built a satellite. We built like things in aerospace where not so many women are like, I mean, becoming the leader in the sector and also decision maker. But luckily, I'm one of the decision makers. So I know the condition of the women empowerment in the sector, especially in the high tech sector. Okay. So what's important at the moment is to me is still back to the foundation, the education. Before we go to the law, before we go to the authority, education is the most important thing, whether for women or even for the government, I mean, plus the authority, it is essential. I believe that all of us ladies here will agree with me. Education is not all about in school, but education is also about awareness for the women, awareness for the government or people in power. So that is actually my personal view based on my sector.
Absolutely, absolutely correct. It does start off with education. Thank you very much for that. Ankita and Ayadi, would you like to add on to that?
Yes, we do agree with our fellow panelists. The education is a must. So apart from the traditional education, financial awareness is also important for all women to, you know, manage their wealth. So no matter what stream they complete their education in, but financial awareness is something which is important for everyone, each and everyone. So yes, educating women about how to manage their wealth is really very important before we talk about the various schemes the authorities will like pitch in and other things.
Yeah, just to add on to what I guess Dr. Abigail as well as Sue also pointed out, that it's not just about education. For example, this is what we see in STEM as well, that even being in a university that gives access to, again, marginalized communities, you have a certain parity that you want to say that, okay, this is not just based on gender, but it's also based on your economic viability. You still see less than 30% women in fields like remote sensing, in everything other than biosciences, for example. You see less and less of women. This is even worse, for example, in mechanicals or things related to, for example, more hands-on work. And that not just adds on to the idea of first survival rates of women, the girl child, for example, but also the perceived security and the given security of women in these fields. So that also adds on to, do you study financial economics because you like finance, or do you have access to financing and are you secure enough?
I think it's such a complex topic and there's just so many different components to it. Adding on, you know, the demographic that the woman is also in, you know, also in terms of the various factors that are influencing that. I think personally that there needs to be a unified global policy to support women, for instance, you know, depending on the different categories that there are. So we have like a saying that the one size glove does not fit all. So some of these policies that are currently in place, they might not help some women. They might help you. They might lead to some of the women slipping through the cracks. What if you have a single working mother who has recently, for instance, become unemployed and who's also disabled? How is she going to support her children? What kind of safety mechanisms for her are there, especially if she's a migrant, if she's not a citizen of the country and she is a migrant? What is she put through? And not only what is she put through, what are her children put through? Because we have to get rid of this idea when we talk about women that we're just talking about a singular individual. We're not. Because oftentimes with that woman, there are so many connections. And if it's a mother, then you have to, when you talk about the woman, you have to take into account the impact that it has on the children. When a migrant woman becomes unemployed, it doesn't just affect her, it affects her children too. And this is something that really needs to be discussed, because we talk about developing global systems. We talk about that on a marketing level. We talk about that, oh, we have all these organizations, we're doing all of this. But when you actually look at the grand reality, and when a mother has to go hungry to feed her children, I think that's when we kind of come into realize that the grand reality is different to what is actually being portrayed in the media. And this is where the grassroots needs to come into play. This is now just one example. What about the examples of, for instance, Ayadi, you touched upon the topic of marriage. What about in households, for instance, where there are mainly sisters and the burden of the family? And this happens in some cultures, where the burden is on the family to provide. And sometimes you might have the elder sister working and earning, so all the youngest and the middle sister and everybody else can move forward in life with their education, move forward in their life with, you know, with the family systems. But they'll be the earner that the parent, the elderly parents are dependent on. So we are living in a time where we say it's acceptable for women to be sacrificed. But those sacrifices are not necessary, and those sacrifices are not helping anybody, really. Those sacrifices are actually, in turn, affecting the economy in a negative way. They're affecting family in a negative way and society in a negative way. So taking these kind of little snapshots, because this is just part, some details in terms of part of the bigger picture, what are the key components and effective implementation of women-centric financial literacy programs that we can think about?
To even try to work on this is that, I think Sue touched on this idea that participation of women in these spaces fundamentally lack.
What I see these days, of course, is different few years back, because there are a lot of things happening. If we want to rely on certain statistic or cases, you know, case by case, we say case by case, it might be different, especially after COVID-19. And now we have some, I think everyone know about geopolitical problems that change a lot of landscape about whatever program that what we want to do in this world. Not only about economy, but it's about women empowerment and also this program literacy for the women. We need a lot of, I would say, committed responsibility to this. You know, it's easy to say, but commitment is not easy. Because to do the program, you know, from the, I'm not saying lower level, but the zero ground, until to the upper level, it needs a commitment. Especially when the condition is not like really like before. It's it takes, I would say, effort to bring everyone, you know, in this world. Because Anum was mentioning about, you know, there must be like a policy or law in this world to unify this thing. If you ask my personal opinion from my, I would say, from my experience, it's not easy. Why? It's possible. It's possible, but it's not easy. Why? Every region have their own, I would say, custom-made problem. I mean, their own regional problems. Maybe us in Southeast Asia is quite different. Maybe in Africa is quite different. In India is different. In UK is different. So we have to go region to region. If we want to unify, I think we can do, but it's more to the fundamental, but not by case. Case by case, it must be done by the, like a special custom-made program. For example, women in India know what is the problem in India, how to make a custom-made program for women empowerment and financial women program in India.
The financial literacy program must be customized, and it should be inclusive of all the categories, of all the categories, social categories and women. So like, for example, migrant women or women who are working on daily wages, they need to manage their finances, their wages accordingly. But women in tech, they also need some financial awareness. So the literacy program should include the needs of all the categories of women in working in different sectors. So yeah, it should be inclusive.
I think effective women, eccentric financial literacy programs also should be tailored on, interactive learning methods should be accessible, and then access to affordable services that, women around the world need. And then most importantly, one thing that I think we have all pondered on is mentorship. Mentorship in every sense, so that, they will know what they are getting themselves into, what they will get in return, and what they hope to accomplish at the end of the day. And then also regular evaluation of these things that we have, these actions that we have inputted out there. And then also, we should also involve ourselves in implementation, like purposely understanding the audience.
I think what you all touched upon is really relevant. The custom-made approach is absolutely, because like you said, each region has its own sort of its own way of operating, and it's so important to empower the local population. What role do you think financial institutions can play in empowering women through inclusive products?
I'm sharing from my country's experience, Malaysia. I feel very blessed because my country really have, I would say, a policy. We call the policy of 30%. It's not priority, like 30% that you have to give to women, meaning to say whether finance facilitation or any, you know, things related to women empowerment, including in the boardroom. So in most banks, in most government division, they always have a program to encourage and develop ladies for Malaysian. Okay. For example, I am doing international business, international trade. I'm in an international trade. And my name is recognized by my Ministry of International Trade and Investment. So there is one division we call MATrade. They have a division to develop women exporter, just for women. And it's not only one ministry, but other ministry and other division as well. So government of Malaysia, they really take serious of women empowerment development. Not only just to develop in the program, but also inclusive with the finance facilitation, and they have for SMEs. You know, like many women, they have an SMEs, and SMEs is like actually contribute a lot in not only in Malaysia, but I think most countries in the world, SMEs are the one who control the economy. If you know the fact, SMEs is, you know, very, very important to most of the countries in the world. So in Malaysia itself, because I'm talking in the context of Malaysia, the SMEs business owners in Malaysia, I would say it runs by many Malaysian business, by women, Malaysian business women. So the government take note of this. So they have this, I would say, maybe a program. It's not maybe, it's really a program that they have for finance, for adversary, you know, if you want to do this business or that business, whether SME, export, or whatever, the government is giving the facilitation. So I'm speaking from my side, you know, Southeast Asia and also other countries like Japan, Korea, and China. I would say Malaysia have a extra advantages in a women freedom, in a way, getting our freedom, whether to speak or to do business. This business thing is not inclusive with about discrimination, because discrimination is normal. Like, but for the government itself, they are very supportive for the women to get involved in business, in other things. Like they want women to come out to become a business leader in their own field. So that is a perspective of Malaysia situation when it comes to the role of financial institution. You see, most of the banks in Malaysia, I'm talking about bank operating in Malaysia, whether they are international or local bank, because every banks are subjected to our central bank. Government have ruled out that every bank must have a program to help women, like, you know, like giving facilitation, or they need money, what do you call the micro, you know, the micro, what do you call microfinance, right?
Microfinance.
Yes, microfinance. And Malaysia Bank have that, because that is the policy by the government. You must have that kind of policy in all banks. It's very rare not to find Malaysia Bank not to have that. So again, I would say that being in Malaysia, I would say a little bit blessed, because of the government, it's really take quite serious, you know, to give some kind of a support to women in the sector.
I mean, it's such a wonderful initiative, Sue, and it's also a global initiative, because I'm sure this is like a global model that, you know, nations can learn from, because it empowers women and it recognizes, you know, that women have the family unit as well to take care of. These policies like this that really go a long way to support, because you kind of look at it from a human perspective. So, you know, these policies, they're adaptive. They're there to kind of support, like little nuggets of support to help individuals on their journey. I want to ask, in terms of addressing challenges of marginalized women in financial literacy and economic access, what kind of strategies could be employed there?
I think if I were to come in again, because we had the economic survey released for 2022 and 2023 of India, we have a little more nuanced insight now on what is happening here. So if you talk about, for example, I think we reached this idea of migrant laborers and again, vulnerable communities. The first part of every policy is that we still don't have a definition of vulnerability. We still don't have a normalized index of measuring vulnerability. And then the definition itself of what becomes, for example, a migrant laborer, a gig economy worker, self-employment, etc. So these are, again, spaces that make sort of the vulnerable population even more vulnerable to exploitation because there are no certain definitions. And that's not just from country to country. There's also a global difference when it comes to policies as well. But talking about the more positive sides, for example, we have had a huge boom in self-help groups. These are, again, groups which are formed from probably 20 to 25 women. And you have that leadership sort of bringing in more and more women workers. For example, if you take the context of Indian villages, you have pickles and chips and these sort of small products that, again, because of the allied industry with agriculture, because, again, we don't have a definition of rural. Even in urban design and urban planning, we call everything which is not urban rural. That's a global problem of even understanding what is rural. But when you come to these self-help groups, for example, India has had dispersed about ₹1 billion for 1 year for, again, in a way of blended finance. So this is not a model of microfinance per se, but also sort of a grant and a loan kind of a method. So usually we say that grant is something that would be more beneficial, but giving them loans, giving them the idea that, hey, this is, again, as you said, Anam, a little nugget of help and you're supposed to pay it back because your business would definitely be more successful. That is sort of the model of SHGs. And there are about more than 12 million of these around the country. So this, again, operates on the idea that these are not just small industries, but also these are, again, self-help groups either tied with the village. And they, again, demand for more structures of finance. For example, if you take my state, for example, Maharashtra, you've had villages specifically demand that, hey, we need a class, we need a workshop to understand what to do with financing. We want to know more about stocks, for example.
And detail with lots of different aspects and bubbles of varying understandings that if we tap into and if we kind of work towards can make an amazing difference. Now, if you think about leveraging technology for women's financial literacy and empowerment in underserved areas, what would the conversation be like on that?
Again, just start us off. I would like us to talk more about, so there's a saying, again, if you want to work in, again, rural areas, you want to work in appropriate technology. Because, for example, when we research about solar panels, for example, what we found out in Zambia was that there are a lot of hunters and there are a lot of young children around the areas that play with stones and catapults. So it always gets damaged. So again, the intervention of technology itself needs to be appropriated to that area. The scale needs to be something that the people over there can, again, experiment with. Because sometimes, again, it adds to behavioral change. It adds to the kind of local culture and heritage the people themselves have. That if that technology does not add into that system that already exists, it oftentimes becomes very destructive. And that's one thing that we learn globally again and again, that, for example, you have a threat of completely eradicating cultures if you're not careful with the kind of technology interventions you go on. And coming back to the financial literacy part, we have always focused on a digital backbone because we say that, again, it's a digitalized economy. And one good sort of a silver lining that COVID especially had for countries like ours is that people were forced to go to the digital realm to, again, access what was happening, to, again, get access to the platforms for not just selling and buying, but also very basic needs, for example, education itself, which became completely online. And that sort of added that extended layer of why can't financial services be, again, provided for the people we're concerned with. So one of the examples is the e-cart mechanisms or the e-markets that India started having that farmers can, in essence, in theory, again, assess the kind of prices they would get for their goods in the market. So one part is understanding the context. The second one is, again, having these already existing technologies be modified. And the third one would be not just testing it out in the rural areas, but also understanding that whatever we simulated back in the lab, back in controlled conditions, would definitely change when it's applied on ground. And I think that nuance with scientists, researchers, and academicians alike, to, again, understand that it changed, be okay with that change, and, again, reiterate it to, again, so it becomes, again, viable in that area think these three points are something that comes to my mind.
Okay, hi. So what I have to say with this with regards to the leveraging technology is that there should be that kind of financial literacy and then empowerment in underreserved or underserved areas, I mean, in our various countries where we find ourselves. And this would involve providing access to mobile banking for these women, because many of them are into entrepreneurship. They have what they are doing, they are career women, that they don't have that access to that kind of access to mobile banking that they should have. These services, they lack it. And then also, there should also be online financial education resources. Everybody uses social media these days. Almost everyone has what we call smartphones that access internet, that they can go online and search for more information based on their field or even outside of their field of what they do. So if there's this online, that kind of online financial resources with regards to education, that would also help. And then most importantly, there should be that kind of saving. It can be digital saving or in-person saving or however that can be done. And then lending platforms for them to also help with the businesses they are doing. Yeah, I think this is the little I would say. Yeah. Thank you.
Talking about the leveraging technology for women's financial literacy, I think now in the digital economy, we could get the help of for these technologies in educating women on how to regrow their wealth. So as we have seen in most of the Asian families specifically, women do save their wealth. They have their savings in terms of fixed assets. So they do save it for a period of time, but they don't grow it. So the research, as per the research also, it's been seen that most of the women don't just grow their wealth over a long period of time. And while saving money is important, it is also equally important to invest your money in the right way, so as to grow it over a period of time, looking into the uncertainty of the economy, of the global economy. It is very, very important to, regrow your wealth accordingly. So, yes, now since we have technology at fingertips, we could use it. It is not necessary to use the technology use it for transactions. For example, in villages, specifically in Indian villages, educating women to do the transactions online would be little. It will take little efforts, specifically for women who are not that literate, that much. Because a certain level of literacy is required to do money transactions online. So if that is not possible for those women, we can at least educate them on how to invest their money in a right way. What all options are there available for them for specific sectors of the women, specifically women who are farmers, who are working in farming, who are working in small-scale businesses and villages, as some examples are quoted by fellow panelists. So for them, we can at least educate them on how they can use their money, what all options are available for them with the help of technology. So yes, educating women on investment can be done through technology. And that is, I think, an easy way to use technology right away for different sectors of women, specifically marginalized sectors. Thank you.
My experience in my region, not only in Malaysia, because we are at the Southeast Asia, sharing the experience about leveraging technology is very interesting, because If you, I don't know, I'm not too sure like how much exposure or knowledge that you know about at the Asia side, and especially Southeast Asia. Southeast Asia inclusive with Indonesia, Thailand, Singapore. At our side, digital economy, I would say, you know, leveraging the technology for the economy, it's very, very, it's not only encouraging, it's very interesting in a way that everybody must link themselves to the digital economy. Even in Malaysia, we have a government agency called Malaysia Digital Economy Corporation, just to cater the digital, leveraging technology for the business. And we are not focusing all this big giant company, you know, but we are focusing how the people, the normal people, the SMEs, the micros, they can do business using the smartphone. Like Dr. Abigail was talking, like nowadays, you know, everything is easy using a smartphone. In Indonesia itself, where the population is nearly 300 million, I mean, everyone knows Indonesia have like one of the highest population in the world. I mean, I cannot compare with India, like 1 billion. I'm talking about like at my region, like Indonesia have about 300 million. How they do it is they use this technology, they leverage the technology using the handphone to, I would say, to encourage the economy at the rural areas. You know, like some people, the farmers, they are selling all the products. They just put like make an advertisement in the online. So they have like, you know, in our site, we have Shopee, we have all this Lazada, all these apps, you know, all these economic apps. So it's easy for those in the SME and micros just to put their products, even they are at the rural areas. So this situation, I'm not too sure, happen in India or maybe in Africa, I don't know, but I'm just sharing from my side of my region where it give a lot. It give a lot of benefit, especially to those women. You know, women, they are so active, especially from the, I'm not saying remote, we say villages, you know, villages in our side, and mostly they are in a farming sector. So they are able to sell, you know, mostly sell their products. And it do good, you know, to I don't want to say underprivileged, because having smartphone now, whether you're underprivileged or privileged, everyone have handphones and everyone can leverage the handphone, whether you want to do it in a you know, Ankita was saying, whether you want to invest in the right way, you don't want to invest in the right way, it's a very important. But I can see at my side, those people with having a handphone, sometimes even two, because they have business. And business over here in Asia is basically online. You don't need to have like, you know, like a very expensive or ever laptop. You have a smartphone, like Dr. Abigail said, enough, you can make business. This is our side of our region. Maybe, you know, you can share for your own region.
No, that is very true. And if I were to just add that, for example, one of the very heartfelt examples I have is of a friend, Nidhi Pant, and that is a completely online, full stack development technology and a database for farmers and farm growers. And now it has grown to about 12,000 different farmer growers. And it allows for exactly this, that you already have the produce. For example, you have tomato, and you cannot store it for long, so you can make ketchup out of it. And there are such simple solutions that actually add to the economy, with about 800 entrepreneurs and women growers. So their company, S4S Technology, has recently got the Earthshot Prize. And it's honestly like things like these that start with small spaces lead to such vulnerable populations who already want to do something, and they want this just one person or this one group to help. And then you come in with such large donors. And again, the problem of financing itself, that it just literally a chain and a system of things happening. So it's really, really true. And it's quite nice to hear that it's happening all over the world.
Fantastic. Some really wonderful insights there. So we'll now make our concluding statements and just give our insights on the topic. I think for myself, what I've learned from this discussion is that it's a very layered and complex topic, and women's economic empowerment and financial literacy are now in the 21st century, especially in 2024, they're necessities now. They're not luxuries, they're actually necessities for society to move forward, for communities to move forward. And I think a unified global approach would be a step in the right direction to really ensure that the reality on the ground matches up to the policies that we see in the media or the slogans of female empowerment that we hear about. I've also learned that whether, again, the women are in the global north or global south or wherever they are in the world, there are sort of the challenges that they're coming across economically, and there needs to be this further development of a financial toolkit to really empower female communities.
This is what I see, and it has proven that this works, okay? It's really works, because nowadays, if you want to empower economy, it doesn't matter finance or whatever, but in the scope of economy, you must bring technology in, okay? Like Anom say, it is not about luxury thing now. It's a part of necessity, okay? So what I see is, I'm talking about women for the women benefits or women empowerment, okay? There's a two things women can do. This one is general for women, whether you're educated, not educated, privileged or underprivileged. This two things works. Number one, you must involve technology into your life. For example, like Dr. Abigail was mentioning about, you know, the use of the smartphone. That is like at least you must know how to use it in a positive way, meaning to say doing business, economy, reach a right person. Second is about networking. These days, networking is very powerful. You cannot wait for your government. You cannot wait for the authority to come and regulate policy. Sometimes when the policy is there, some people are already dead. Okay? So you have to start with that group. So what you should do is when you network, you're perhaps reaching the right person. You will meet the right person. You know, like the moment you network, you start to realize, I fit in this group. I fit with this kind of a perspective. This is very important, all right? Because I don't want to talk something so big, so whatever, because at the end of the day, we are just normal human being. I mean, normal women, every day-to-day life. How many women have the privilege like us to be educated, to be privileged, to get connected, this and that? So I prefer to talk something like, you know, like every woman, whether privileged, not privileged, educated, not educated, everybody can do this.
I think it adds to what you said, Anam, that I have also sort of learned about the nuances of the regional and local differences, and also the way that all of these are combined together, that the needs of women together are alike. They are different in terms of their context, but we do need a lot of systemic change that needs to happen in a global level.
I think, yes, a very inclusive literacy program is something which can definitely benefit women of all the sectors, catering to their needs. And yes, programs focusing on rebuilding their wealth and managing their wealth for different sectors of women, specifically the marginalized women, is really necessary. And I think, a community will definitely help women to share their needs and manage their wealth accordingly. So, yeah.
So I think I would come in with this mentorship I made mention of. Yes. Once we get that kind of mentorship we want or we need, I think it can open so many doors to us, because most of us women, we want to get into some spaces, but we don't have that kind of mentorship or that kind of idea and concept to, you know, fit in there or do something impactful in the space we are in. So I think mentorship is very important.